Good morning, early birds. You've caught The Worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio rounding up reporting from our newsroom and Montana Public Radio. Today we have stories about the Good Neighbor Agreement, comparing Montana and Wyoming's recreation economies, and an update on the Superfund site in Anaconda. It's Monday, November 4th. I'm your host, Jess Sheldahl. The state and the U.S. Forest Service plan to ramp up a program on Montana's national forests that uses timber sales with restoration components to fund non-commercial conservation work. The amount of timber currently being cut under the program could grow four times over the next year. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports the timber industry sees that as a much-needed boon.
A large industrial harvester is sawing quickly through trees on the Liger timber sale near West Glacier on the Flathead National Forest. The Liger sale was sold under what's known as the Good Neighbor Authority, a cooperative agreement between the Montana Department of Natural Resources and Conservation and the Forest Service. The authority, authorized under the 2014 Farm Bill, allows the state to work on timber and conservation projects on federal land. DNRC's Neil Simpson.
With Good Neighbor Authority, the long-term intent is to have a diversity of projects, both timber sales, which generate revenue while they accomplish restoration objectives, but also other activities such as culvert replacement to improve fish habitat, or road improvements to reduce sediment into streams, and wildfire risk reduction.
So far, the Liger sale is the third Good Neighbor project to get off the ground in Montana. All three have been timber sales, generating 8.3 million board feet and about $1 million. Those proceeds are supposed to pay for the state's work and future commercial and non-commercial Good Neighbor restoration projects. Officials say they are starting with timber sales to create a self-sustaining program. The state legislature gave DNRC $2.2 million to hire a handful of staff in order to get the program off the ground. The logging and timber industry see benefit in this program, too. Five wood product companies committed $450,000 to get more timber sales out for bid.
I know, talking to the at Forester, they're putting up more sales. I mean, they're working on them. So that's good. It's a start. You got to start somewhere.
Kevin St. Ange is the owner of St. Ange Logging and purchased the Liger sale. He says the Forest Service has been slow to get timber sales out to bid in recent years, but with the advent of Good Neighbor, he says things are looking up, and others agree.
So yeah, Good Neighbor Authority, I think, is the best thing. And I've been doing this stuff for 31 years. I think Good Neighbor Authority is the best thing. It's like sliced bread. It's the best.
Julia Altimus is the executive director of the Montana Wood Products Association, and she says the state's logging and lumber industry has been on a slow upswing since 2008, when the recession brought home construction nationwide to a screeching halt. But she says that wasn't the only problem the industry faced around that time. About 500 million board feet of federal timber sales in Montana were getting held up in court.
The typical logging truck has 5,000 board feet of timber on a logging truck. So if you do the math, it's an incredible amount of timber that was supposed to go to the mills that did not.
She says the industry has nearly recovered from that time, thanks in part to the Forest Service ratcheting up its harvest goals under the Trump administration and hitting them, particularly in Montana and northern Idaho. The Forest Service is currently in the planning phases for 9 Good Neighbor projects in Montana. A number of those could move forward this federal fiscal year, producing up to 32 million board feet, on top of the expected harvest of about 420 million.
Headway capacity for the industry right now is between 500 and 600 million board feet, so we could almost be back whole again.
But Altimus says that's barring any of these sales winding up in court, which so far hasn't happened. But concerns have been raised by some conservation groups about states having an economic incentive to push timber sales without a real restoration component, which Good Neighbor timber sales are required to have.
They're letting the state take over a significant part of the sale administration, basically letting your neighbor come in and sort your own pantry. that's what's going on here.
Jeff Rook is the Pacific Director for the Washington, D.C.-based Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, or PEER. His organization brought this very concern up to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Inspector General regarding a timber sale in southeast Alaska.
Good Neighbor was not a win-win, it was a misnomer, in that there was no restoration work done. There was no reforestation, even in areas where there were clear cuts.
While the logging industry in southeast Alaska has been in dire straits for years, others in Montana share PEER's concern that sales could be pushed through under the guise of restoration to boost both the statewide and local economies. It's a question Montana stakeholders MTPR spoke with are thinking about, but want to withhold judgment until the program is in full swing. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
Yellowstone National Park officials say that despite the challenges of managing visitors eager to photograph wildlife in the park, the number of conflicts involving humans and bears was low in 2018. Yellowstone biologist Carrie Gunther says in the park's annual bear report that it was a considerable challenge to manage visitors who stopped to view and photograph bears foraging in roadside meadows. The Cody Enterprise reports rangers were notified of 1,627 grizzlies and black bear sightings in 2018. Evidence is mounting that wild North American bison are gradually shedding their genetic diversity across many of the isolated herds overseen by the U.S. government. Advances in genetic testing are bringing the concern into sharper focus. Preliminary results of a genetic population analysis commissioned by the National Park Service shows three small federal conservation herds would almost certainly die off within 200 years under current wildlife management techniques. Figures from the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis indicate that Montana outpaces neighboring Wyoming when it comes to recreation economies. The Billings Gazette reports that using data from 2017, the analysis puts Montana's outdoor recreation value at $2.3 billion compared to $1.6 billion in Wyoming. This is the first national report to drill into state-by-state recreation economies. Rachel Vandevort, director of the Montana Office of Outdoors Recreation, says the state-by-state analysis is helpful in making decisions such as investing in habitat, protecting public or private lands, and contributing funding to new opportunities. University of Wyoming economics professor Rob Godby attributes the disparity between the two states to Montana's larger population and more urban areas, which means more business catering to hunters, anglers, skiers, and bikers. Federal investigators that study public health risks at Superfund sites had good news for anacondas last week. At a meeting last Wednesday, they reported that the amount of lead and arsenic in residents' bodies are about the same as the rest of the country. Montana Public Radio's Nora Sachs has more.
The Superfund cleanup of the massive Anaconda smelter site has been underway since 1983. But Smelter City residents still have a lot of questions about how healthy their community is and whether they're being exposed to contaminants from the historic smelter pollution. Primarily,
what people want to know, they said, well, 35 years into Superfund, how do we compare to the rest of the country?
David Dorian is a health assessor with the Federal Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, ATSDR for short. At a meeting at Anacondas High School on Wednesday, he told about 25 people that the agency just finished a health study aimed at answering that question.
I want to cut right to the chase. The overarching conclusion of our investigation after a year of looking at all the statistics and accumulating all the information is that the lead and arsenic levels in members of the Anaconda community who participate in the study are comparable to the U.S. population as a whole.
ATSDR came to their conclusion by doing an exposure investigation, which means
we're looking at what's in your body, right? We're trying to measure that somehow. So blood samples are used to evaluate lead exposure. Urine samples are used to evaluate arsenic.
Lead and arsenic are both contaminants of concern in Anaconda. Lead can cause developmental and neurological issues in babies and young children. In adults, it can affect the cardiovascular system. Long-term exposure to arsenic is known to increase the risk of certain cancers. The thing is, both lead and arsenic leave the body quickly, a couple of days for arsenic, and a few weeks for lead. That means this type of study only reveals very recent exposures.
It tells us about the now, it informs decisions about the future, but it doesn't tell us about historic exposures.
But since the same kind of blood lead and urinary arsenic data is collected by the Centers for Disease Control through a comprehensive nationwide survey, ATSDR can compare apples to apples and see how recent exposures in Anaconda stack up to the national average. So in fall 2018, ATSDR partnered with local and state agencies to collect blood and urine samples and health questionnaires from the Anaconda community. The testing was free, voluntary, and surprisingly popular. 367 residents participated, which Dorian said is the highest turnout they've ever gotten for any exposure investigation anywhere in the country.
We sold out, in so many words.
There's no magic number, but he says that sample size is big enough to be a meaningful evaluation and was representative of local demographics. After sharing the overall good news that exposure levels in Anaconda are basically normal, David Dorian with ATSDR then broke the study results down further. As far as lead goes, there's no safe level. But all the children tested, which are the most vulnerable group, had blood lead values below the CDC's level of concern, which is 5 micrograms per deciliter. For kids and adults in Anaconda combined, the median blood lead level was also below that benchmark, but statistically a little higher than the rest of the country.
We don't believe these have any clinical difference. In other words, we would not think that there would be any difference in health effects between these two groups because the difference is so small and health effects are a multiple of factors.
Arsenic is more complicated because there's no predetermined threshold like there is for lead, and there are several kinds.
When we talk about contamination from a smelter, we're referring to inorganic arsenic.
Only inorganic arsenic, not organic arsenic, is a toxin. ATSDR found that Anaconda residents, on average, actually had slightly lower inorganic arsenic levels than the rest of the U.S. population. But people who said they entered their attics regularly had slightly higher levels of both lead and arsenic, because some attics are still contaminated with smelter dust. David Dorian stressed that while overall, ATSDR's exposure investigation shows that lead and arsenic levels in Anaconda are about the same as the rest of the country.
Contamination remains in the community. So these results should not be taken to mean that that risk has been eliminated. It means that presently, at this point in time, it looks as though those exposures are largely being controlled.
Not all locals were convinced. Terry Galley, a retired plumber, emphasized how much pollution remains in many attics in Anaconda.
Now, are we trying to fix that problem, or are we trying to hide it?
Right.
And it looks like we're trying to hide it.
He questioned ATSDR's methodology and findings, and the fact that their study only looks at current, not past exposures. Galley says when the copper smelter was running,
at 10 tons a day piling out of that smokestack every day for probably 80 years, it had to land somewhere. And so I'm saying it's landing on our community, and we're not doing anything to protect the folks. And that's why I was hoping to hear from you guys and hear a good solution to the dilemma, because so far I haven't heard that.
Anaconda Deer Lodge County Chief Executive Bill Everett had much more confidence in the study and said the results of ATSDR's independent research mean he can now tell people that Anaconda is a safe place to live.
This is probably the most thorough study from probably the most competent party, from probably the most politically neutral party you could ever be involved with. So yeah, it is good information.
ATSDR's goal is not just to study exposure to contaminants, but to look for ways to decrease it. Public health officials gave locals detailed information on how to protect themselves at home and at work. They also had recommendations for the Environmental Protection Agency and Atlantic Richfield, the company on the hook for the Superfund cleanup. The big ones were to expand the cleanup of contaminated yards and homes, especially attics, and minimize the risk of exposure at the uncovered piles of slag, another form of smelter waste, in town. ATSDR's recommendations are non-binding, but since the Superfund parties in Anaconda are currently hammering out a final cleanup deal, they come at a crucial time. After the meeting, Charlie Coleman with EPA So the recommendations are consistent with the direction the parties are now heading with the cleanup. They're looking at capping the slag piles and...
There's a more comprehensive attic dust plan coming. We can't provide details at this point in time. That's part of the negotiation, but the fact that there's a more comprehensive plan coming, I think we can say that. We've said that before.
ATSDR said these kinds of exposure investigations are expensive, and they only do about 4 per year across the country. EPA said they will attempt to recover the cost of this health study from Atlantic Richfield once their lawyers get the bill. To read ATSDR's full exposure investigation report, check out our website, mtpr.org. I'm Nora Sachs, Montana Public Radio.
And that's what's happening in Montana today. Check in with Montana Public Radio's Montana Evening News for updates on the news of the day. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. We'll have another episode of The Worm for you early birds tomorrow morning.
The Worm is produced by Jess Sheldahl for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Meadowlark Call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. Partial funding for The Worm is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.